Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric 13. This is Double Feature, a podcast about our two favorite albums by the Canadian band Kitty, and joining me is Michael Kester.
Oh my God, you're on this kitty kick.
Another week with the kitty.
Did you just find out about Kitty?
I just discovered this band Kitty, let me tell you
okay,
about them.
Yeah.
New metal band. Surprisingly, coincidentally, from when I was in middle school.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just want to clarify, you're saying they're a new metal band, but not that they are an N-E-W, new metal band. They are a N-U with an umlaut metal band, meaning they were relevant 15 years ago.
It's ironic. The umlaut is ironic. That's how the whole thing works. Good. Well, we've got our kitty fact for the day down. In fact, I think we've got a few too many kitty facts today. And not enough factoids about Dan Aykroyd. This is Double Feature, a show that just began on Fargo and Blade Runner. That's the first episode. You can go back to that. You can catch up, learn all about Kitty, learn about movies, learn mostly about our mental issues. And then you will be primed for today's episode about two movies that have nothing to do with any of that.
Today's episode is our year 12 finale. We're doing Boca and
The
Signal.
It's not the year 12 finale. We have so many more
episodes. If you
don't
go to the Patreon, which is patreon.com/doublefeature, and prevent this from being a year-end finale. A person who did prevent this from being today's year-end finale, or I guess prevented last week from being the year-end finale, is John, who suggested Boca. Remember Boca?
Yes.
The film we're covering today.
Yeah, man, I remember Boca. Come on.
Good. Sorry, that was just
I can retain
pop
at
quiz.
Least.
Pop quiz.
Look, we know this well from doing the show. I can remember exactly four films worth of content.
Yep.
Once I hit the fifth film, one of them disappears out of the other side of the memory box.
To be fair, I feel like there is an error in our sample set where you may, in fact, remember five films, but that does us no good in the context of this podcast. So yeah, we know for certain six films don't work.
Right. Well, once we hit Killapalooza territory, we'll see how many fucking films I can remember.
Four.
One
it's
time.
Still four.
Okay. All right. Well, there we have it. Look, we're solving more riddles. Patreon.com/doublefeature. That's where John found us. Actually, John found the show. So dear Podmanity, you may also have a similar journey to John. John found this show, Double Feature. He listened to a few episodes. He said, I'm not putting into your fucking Patreon. And then he listened to a couple more and a couple more. And then one day the podcast stopped showing up and John's heart was broken. I mean, that didn't really happen.
No.
But it could happen to you. Patreon.com/doublefeature.
I know for a fact that that didn't happen because John also gave to the Kickstarter, which is a pre-Patreon. It's a prehistoric way to keep your podcast alive.
Is that before Indiegogo? What is a Kickstarter?
It's an Indiegogo where you never make any money.
Anyways, point is, through the Patreon, John recommended the film Boca, which despite having Micah Monroe in it, I had never even fucking heard of. And then I saw the cover and exactly like advertising tells you to, I went, cool cover. Let's talk about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that was all I needed to be sold on Boca. And then we also have The Signal.
Which is a film you chose.
It has to go second because not only is it called The Signal, so it just sounds like it should. There's a little midnight going on in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little, what did you say last week that you'd never seen a movie like The Signal?
That's true.
And I want to say, for a film that could be considered a horror anthology, not typically the type of movie you go, I've never seen a film like this before.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the kind of movie you go, I've seen 100,000 fucking films like this before.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be a special one. So I said something on the last episode of the show, and I was curious if you were familiar with the term Boca, because in a film that doesn't give you a lot of clues and spends a lot of time meditating, you tell me if this sounds like this could key into some conversation about this movie.
Okay, you're about to give me more to talk about in this film. Great.
You know, there's this photography bit that's in the movie, this old camera. And bokeh is the word that describes, when we talk about like a shallow depth of field in a movie, the bokeh describes basically the part that is out of focus.
Mm-hmm.
Really more specifically, it's like the quality of that part. You know, when you talk about the bokeh, it's usually to talk about, it's like a fine detail of photography. When you have a shallow depth of field, it's because you want people to look at the part that's in focus and not out of focus.
Mm-hmm.
But the bokeh is the out of focus part. And it's really used in conversation when people are considering like the quality of light and the quality of how the lens captures that.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start paying attention to photography at such an insane level that you're going, yeah, but how's the blurry part of the photo? Is that part good?
Mm-hmm.
You really got the high quality blur. So I think for not only talking about things that are out of focus, but also a term that really talks about how light is represented in those areas. It's such a perfect fitting thing for this movie. It seems like exactly where this movie's head's at.
It sounds like a good word to describe the metaphorical thing that's going on in this movie, but it definitely seems, I wouldn't say it's a clue. I don't think it clues you in on anything. I think it definitely is a good sort of catch-all word to, if you needed one word, you know, like say you were trying to, I don't know, make a title for a film.
I know, I just thought it was such a fitting.
And I had no idea.
One of the cool things when you spend some time with a film that is meditative is you get a sense of the types of things that film would do. Almost, it's sort of in the same arena as a hangout film.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're done with the film and then you know that it's called bokeh, you go, oh yeah, that is the kind of thing bokeh would do, call itself bokeh. That seems like a decision of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed very fitting.
One of the saddest things, and I'm just going to be really blunt about this, and you're probably going to be really frustrated with me, but one of the saddest things about bokeh being on this episode is that it's not on the next episode.
Want to wind because people up for that.
We're going to talk about another film next week that's going to have sort of a similar notion to it. But I think for me, what stands out in this movie, and I'll try to make sure this conversation is different from next week's conversation, but I think what stands out to me in this movie is sort of this really bold-faced and plain question of, you know, you entertain the notion of sort of what would you do, but that's not exactly what the film is. It's not where the film is pointed. And instead, I think it's more about what becomes important in a situation where you and one other person are the only two people left alive. And this, to me, one of the moments that really stuck with me in this movie, and I think is a really interesting place to maybe begin a conversation about bokeh, is when he basically decides, you know what, fucking who cares, photography, whatever. And I'm sitting there and my first thought is like, man, but you need to find some joy. And then my second thought, so immediately I start thinking of this in terms of creating other types of art, right? Photography is probably maybe the worst type of art to use in this film, and in that way the best. But I think if you were to think of it in terms of, you know, music or creating film or creating anything that really has a really long-term sort of bud to full fruition process.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I'm thinking about, right? So I'm thinking if you and one other person are alive and that's it. So it's me and you and nobody's listening. So it's just like Double Feature. And
John. And John's watching. John is in the woods chopping trees and asking for water.
And I come up with this idea for a song, right? 50% of the world's population knows how that song goes right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it sort of becomes like, why go through the arduous process of actually, you know, say recording or transcribing or filming the whole movie when you can just, you know, over dinner go, I came up with this cool idea for a story and describe it. And now 100% of the planet knows the movie.
Yeah.
And why bother?
Yeah, right.
And sort of that resonant question of why bother takes control of this film. And I think it starts asking that question in a lot of different ways. And I think the two main characters have different answers, which results in the end of the film, right? Is I feel like he is constantly attempting to answer the question, why bother, with tangible answers. He's constantly, honestly, and he's actively trying to come up with an answer for that question.
Mm-hmm.
And she is just constantly re-asking that question to the void.
Yeah.
Hoping there is no answer.
Yeah. Is it hoping there is no answer? Because I feel like she is, you know, what's hard is that one of these characters essentially fails to find a reason.
Do you think, I mean, maybe fails to find a reason. I think honestly, it becomes about being equipped with an effective worldview. I think that there's a certain, in a situation like this, I think it's just like, I mean, so much is reduced to the basics of survival that I think you land automatically in sort of a Darwinism where I just don't know that her character is mentally equipped for the pathways needed to desire survival.
Right, yeah.
And I think that it's funny because it spells out sort of this easy disconnect in modern society, like in the world we actually live in, for mental illness and suicidalism.
Yeah,
and just,
yeah.
And it becomes sort of this pragmatic explanation where it goes, well, listen, she just flat out can't see why bother.
Yeah.
She cannot come up with a reason to survive. And it's so much harder to fault her in that world than it is to, say, fault somebody in the world you and I are recording this podcast in. Because you and I can come up with 1,000 different reasons. We can go, but Spider-Man, but the It sequel, you know, all this shit.
Uh-huh.
We can go, you know, but there's only 2 more years of this presidency. Or you never know if...
Or there's only 6 more years of this presidency.
Or maybe they're about to come out with vegan string cheese, which I know right. is a big part of your hope for the future.
It's part of our dynamic, really,
yeah.
that is coming to a head here.
But I think when you strip away the possibility of the next phase of Avengers or the next American president or the next discovery in veganism, it becomes way more cut and dry as to why not just kill yourself.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the two of these people, at the end of the film, one of them is dead and one of them is not. And who's better off? I'd say it's about equal. I'd say they're in about an equal.
What a fucking nihilistic.
But honestly, right? How is his life better now that, what does his life represent as 100% of the human populace?
Yeah, I mean, I thought about that in terms of art too for that same reason, because art is so much of my motivating factor to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
And especially same. Around film, it's like basically fucking impossible to make films on your own. Especially if there's only 2 people, because then who's the audience?
Right.
If 2 people make a film, 0 people watch the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if 50% of the audience isn't around and there's only 2 people, then it's a lot harder to get it made. And it also just seems like what a monumental effort just to turn around and show it to somebody who goes, eh, I would have done it differently. That's what people, that's how an audience reacts. So I don't know, because, you know, there is a, when I talk about the film being meditative, there is a, I felt this, I don't know if you, I felt like there was a, I don't want to say this is universally true, but there's a certain kind of existential dread to, you know, your late 20s,
mm-hmm.
where you're just wondering. I mean, a lot of the people around me, I noticed they wonder about their place in the world. I noticed a lot of people really think about death I mean, I thought about death a lot in my mid-20s and my late-20s. I don't know if I aged out of that or I like suicided out of that or what happened in my life that suddenly went, oh, I don't really care about dying anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when, you know, you ask a lot of these questions about purpose. And in the film, it's a lot of questions about God. And I think all of that is accelerated when you have a chaos event like this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a person yourself who, you know, you and I are both atheists, we don't have religions, we don't believe in a God. What is your ETA in a timeline like this? Tomorrow you wake up and everybody but you and one other person are gone.
Is it you?
Do you start
for this thought experiment?
Does that change it?
It does.
Does it change it because you're quicker to start talking about God just to act as the, I don't want to say devil's advocate, but just to poke the bear a little bit?
Yeah.
Or are you more hesitant because I will make fun of you? Which of those?
I mean, honestly, no.
Do you start asking religious questions, you think?
No, because I don't, that's just not a point of existence for me.
But everybody's left. Everybody's off the planet now. Something incredible has happened.
I'm sure. Yeah. You mean, do I start thinking that maybe there was some version of a rapture? Let me tell you, I can answer that question directly. I didn't even consider that in this film until you just asked me.
I just feel like
for a minute did I go, maybe it was the rapture, until you just asked me right now.
Having always been a person that is, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and I have not shut out the possibility of God. I just have not seen any of the proof, and I see no reason to live my life as if that's an option any more than all of the other things I don't feel like are an option, so I don't think about. So there's no religion in my life.
Mm-hmm.
There's no rapture. There is this book that says a bunch of people are going to disappear. And
there's
if
another
I wake
book
up
that
one
says
day,
that there's a wizard school in England.
Okay, well, if I woke
there's,
up,
there's to be
on,
fair, there's
on.
Fucking seven of those books.
If I woke up tomorrow and there was a wizard school in England, I'd be like, wait a second.
Sure.
Somebody knew about this.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I thought about that as we're doing the film this week for the show. If that ever gets to me, because I'm thinking about if I can relate to this character. One of these characters is going through life going, this is bleak, there's no point, I will jump off a cliff. And I'm like, you know, I like this Mika, I think she's onto something. And then she starts going, let's talk about God. I'm like, wait, I don't know if I'd get there. I just don't know if that would.
I definitely wouldn't. I would definitely, I don't know if it's just where I am in my life or my outlook on something like this, but I would definitely feel a certain liberation, sort of an invigoration and a liberation if this happened. I would definitely be more equipped to attempt to survive. A few things that I definitely would never even consider. Leaving Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
That goes off the table. Planet Earth becomes Iceland.
Yeah, email still works, so you don't really need to worry about.
Planet Earth becomes Iceland. And I would definitely have to, you know, be aware of sort of basic human needs,
mm-hmm,
and attempt to try and better myself in some ways, remain entertained in others. But I think that what's the point? Here's the reality, and I think this is where sort of the mental capacity for this between these two characters is different, is if you ask me right now on this podcast, hey, Michael, what's the point of life? I tell you, there isn't one. We've made up all of it. There's absolutely no importance.
You've often found some great humor in that.
Yeah.
You are somehow tickled by the bleakness of it all.
Yeah.
And I feel like I am out in the ether, being cast into the middle of the ocean and not able to swim,
right,
trying to reach out for some kind of life preserver, right, literal life preserver.
So I feel like, yeah, I'm not under the impression that there is a point to any of this at all, even now.
Yeah.
So I definitely wouldn't start searching for a reason then. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm for whatever reason, maybe I'm the one with, maybe I have the mental health issue, but I don't operate from a place that any of this matters outside of the individuals that I interact with.
Yeah. I've known you for a long time, and look, Anna, because this took a strangely personal turn today, I should let Podmanity know, who does not personally know Michael Kester. This is one of the most fascinating things about you to me. That you are, if we woke up tomorrow and all but two people were gone, that would be like a fun, curious thing to you. Yeah. And I just can't, like, there's a, what continues to elude me in our friendship is the world's view that you have, because we have such a common worldview. We spent so many years on this show talking about atheism, talking about skepticism, talking about the way we come at things. We're still always looking for, you know, divides, political divides that we end up just constantly swapping each other's takes on, and then it doesn't fucking matter anyways. And it's just the one thing that I always come back to that I just don't even, we don't talk about it much because there isn't an answer for it that I feel like I can attain, is just your like fanciful curiosity at the world and general, I don't know, I don't want to call it a lack of concern because that sounds, you know what I mean? That sounds critical. Yeah. You're not just wandering through life with no problems. You struggle like any human does.
Yeah,
but,
for sure.
But just that the things that I consider most dreadful are amusing to you. I mean, I have no other way to say it, really. Like, look at the ending of this movie. This is a sad ending.
Sure.
This is absolutely a bleak ending.
Heartbreaking.
And, you know, we joke about it, but it's also, it's not like, I'm not saying Michael's a robot and doesn't recognize sadness or anything. But I look at this and I kind of wonder, I don't have the you remember Watchmen?
The film or the TV show?
Sure.
Okay.
What's the blue dude's name?
Dr. Manhattan.
Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen.
Yeah.
I have this picture of you like Dr. Manhattan in my mind.
It's kind of, yeah, that's just observing
the human experience.
Yeah.
And just like, huh, well, okay, this is mildly aggravating. Curious.
But I'm wearing CG shorts.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I look at this movie and I go, well, what the fuck was to be done about the ending? How could we have prevented this? How could we? Because I am her character trying to hold on to some reason to keep doing this over and over and over, because that's all I have is that search and eventually some reason, and then occasionally a terrifying slip when that reason, you know, ventures off and have to find a new one. And so when I see somebody take their own life in a movie, I go into this sort of this like panic mode where I have to solve like what are between these two characters, one of them, this is how I look at the movie. I go, okay, here's an interesting test case. One character in this circumstance offed themselves and the other one did not. How do I make sure I'm like the one who did not? How do we at all times follow that line of thinking? And
meanwhile, I'm the cameraman in this film.
I know. That's the thing. That's the thing that fucking kills me. And of course, as always, there isn't an answer, nor is there a transition. To add a transition to the show, patreon.com/double feature. We would like to buy a transition. There's this other movie, The Signal.
Yeah.
So we wanted to talk in the theme today about, God, that was a fucking heavy segment. I don't know what the hell happened there.
No, it's all right. It's okay.
Boca would be proud, would be very proud. And we're proud of you for naming your movie Boca. So The Signal, the idea with the pair with The Signal was, you know, we went down a couple threads, and I actually think, look, stick around for next time on Double Feature, because I think we have a double feature of double features. We have some companion shows.
It's a double feature.
But on this show, we went with the weirder theme, which is you wake up and the world is different.
Mm-hmm.
And so to contrast that to Boca, which is used for emotional ends, meditative ends, and to really think about, you know, what what makes, to really think about the fucking human existence by eliminating most of the human existence. That's bokeh.
Mm-hmm.
And the signal keeps everyone here. Well, it starts that way anyways until the terror breaks out. But it sets up this idea that if this signal goes out and infects people, what happens to those of us who remain? And it does this huge world building and then also tells a small story. So I think that's a reason to contrast it, and that's a reason to compare it. I think the comparison, surprisingly, for a movie that I thought would take, you know, you wake up and the world has changed, would take that and do something very much different with it. Still, logistically, it tells small stories within a large scale, kind of Purge style, right?
Mm-hmm.
A giant thing is happening out there in the world. Let's look at how these characters are moving through it, which is the first clever thing this movie does. But the other thing that's clever, horror anthologies. Let's talk horror anthologies for a second.
Yeah.
Let's, because I'm so elated with The Signal, I never get to do this on the other horror anthology shows, but I really don't like horror anthologies.
Do you? Okay. So let me clarify, because to me, there are two types of horror anthologies.
Mm-hmm.
There is ABCs of Death, which is the one type of horror anthology pushed up to 11. And there's Southbound, which is the other type of horror anthology pushed up to 11. So those two things are differentiated by one major factor, which is how many directors there are in the anthology.
Well, yeah. So I look at it on a line. You know, I think on one, I wouldn't say there's two camps. I would say you start with Pulp Fiction all the way at zero. And you go, Pulp Fiction's even a cheat because it's all one director. But I think Southbound was a pretty good example.
Mm-hmm.
But you start with a movie that is cut into segments and has multiple directors, but is one very coherent story. And there's not a lot of those. There's few and far between. And then they kind of run the gamut all the way to, we have chucked 20 to 30 shorts in 26. This fucking, yeah. So I was thinking of another film that's coming out. We'll talk about it later. Point is, anthologies have a lot of problems. And so some people, you know, they really enjoy anthologies. And I'm the kind of person who has a lot of hangups with them. They're also really interesting to talk about because there's just so much to chew on. Those are the easiest days on double feature because it's like doing a whole Killapalooza full of, it's, hey, could you perhaps speak on the show about these six movies all at once in an hour's time? It's like there's tons of stuff to say. But trying to prove that you are different as a film from the average anthology can be really hard. Anthologies tend to, more and more, they focus on, we're going to give the directors as much freedom as possible, which actually, in this case, I would argue might not be the greatest idea.
No, I definitely don't. I think the
anthologies that are like, here's a letter, run wild, have no, you know, they have no cohesion to them.
Yeah, I definitely feel like when you look at anthologies, the most interesting thing you can do is sort of, it's just like, it's just, we did For Your Consideration.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like riffing on a theme, where if you have actors come into a scene and you go for it, whatever comes out of that scene is going to screw up the rest of your plans for the movie. But if you have actors come into a scene and you go, in this scene, you're going to find out you're nominated for an Academy Award, and go.
Yeah, yeah.
Then suddenly you can still maintain a coherent narrative while letting people put their own spin on the story.
So I think what's most interesting to me about The Signal is, of all these choices then that anthologies make, it chooses a very particular cocktail that sets it up for success. And I don't think it's just the cocktail. I also think, you know, the film shows up and does an amazing job. But right from the start, they seem to have this mindset of how are we standing out. Mm-hmm. They know what's going to prove this movie to be special. From the second the movie opens, it is about making bold choices. You know, mm-hmm. it starts in this kind of, it's not really grindhousey, but like VHS era exploitation. And then it glitch trips the fuck out. You don't know what's going on. When we get back in the real world, a guy is naked. And that's how the movie opens. Mm-hmm. So already the movie's like, bold choices. Here we go. Strap in. And then it has these segments. And the thing in the makeup that really makes this different than other anthologies is without the split of the inner titles, you might not even know it's an anthology. You might not even use that term. And I don't think so. You know, it's one thing to go, well, we're going to make our anthology great by making it a regular movie and not a fucking anthology. That mm-hmm. would be one thing, but it's actually not even that simple either, because each of the three segments has a very distinct tone, but they share the same characters.
Mm-hmm.
And sharing the same characters turns out to be the decision, I think, that makes this movie special above really any of the other great choices that it makes, but it makes it stand out. You start in this really tense scene, people like it, and you know, the thing that sucks if you start your anthology with a great chunk and people love it is then it's over, you know, and then you got another chunk. And so what are you going to do? Let people down? Are they going to like it as much, less? It keeps people constantly evaluating. So when the next segment shows up and people from the first segment start showing up in the second segment, it's almost like a reward for the audience to discover, hey, we didn't even promise you a coherent narrative. You were showing up thinking that's the one thing you weren't getting. Well, here it is.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the coherence is probably, it's a great film in and of itself, but I think within the context of The Signal, coherence is one of the things that it basically plays with the most.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think masterfully. I think when you watch this movie, there's something, and it's binary. There's something between this movie, I have no idea what's happening, and neither do these characters, mm-hmm. or this has a distinct through line and I have followed every beat. And that switch flips over and over throughout this film in such a way for me where I was just, there's just points of it where I just go, I just don't know if I've ever been challenged in a way where I feel like I have to focus so much on something so upsetting.
Upsetting like how?
Upsetting. I mean, just, there's just, it's essentially a film full of unreliable narrators.
Oh yeah.
And I hate it because I'm just going like, how much of this is even going on ever?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you're constantly, that's the problem with The Signal, is that it suddenly makes people various degrees of unreliable. But I mean, what helped me in that is I held on to AJ Bowen's character mm-hmm. as the least reliable person in the room at all times. And that was always kind of my North Star for how the fuck do I get through this? Because, you know, you're panicked, the world is ending all around you. And I'm just thinking, which of these characters can I follow? Who's going to be okay here? Oh, AJ Bowen showed up. He's not going to be okay. Stay the fuck away from him. I love that moment that he comes into the, man, we talk about this guy every once in a while. We've seen him on a couple of these films.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see him some more in our AJ Bowen spiritual successor movie next week. But I genuinely love, I think this is the role to go, oh well, this AJ Bowen guy that you're always talking about, why, what's he in? What do you like him in? This is such a fucking starring role for somebody who is usually a really great cameo in mm-hmm. a House of the Devil or that whole circle of filmmakers. So many of those movies and so many that have been on double feature, but the manic fucking crazy he brings to this movie is just, the camera can just sit on him for an hour. And I just love watching it. All of his tics, the way he is torn between the reality he thinks he understands and just his sort of paranoid interpretation or his point of view of what's going on. And also because of the way that the film shows his point of view, it brings everybody else in on his delusion. So he storms into that room thinking one character is another character. I love watching him perform that. And then I get to see the other characters playing into that performance, which I love because they are part of his delusion. So it's both terrifying and exciting for me in that way. The confusion around who is who at any given time, who can I trust, who out here is going to murder me, and to find somebody who is, I mean, that's one of my favorite kind of roles, is somebody who has a lot of charisma, but is also just manically dangerous, like might go at you with, you know, fucking bolt cutters or whatever the fuck. When she first gets out in the hallway and that guy's coming at her, what is that? What are those, like hedge cutters or the long handles with the, that is, that scene is fucking, that whole sequence, the first chunk of this movie is really such a pulse pounding kind of, I really don't like the word thriller. I feel like that gets misused all the time. But the feeling in my head when people say the word thriller, that's how this first chunk feels to me, where I'm just sweating it out with these people. He walks up to the door and his attention is, you know, he's distracted and she gets in and tries to lock it. And just every little movement of every person in that, I am just fucking sweating it out. And it relieves all of that tension by going to the second segment, which is comedic, very comedic. So what normally, you know, the decision to switch tone is the other one that I think is really dicey in anthologies. Because if you're, again, for the same reason, if you're liking the tone of one movie and that changes, so much of what we like about movies is their vibe. So, you know, if you have a comedy and then a really heavy thing, you know, that might, context sets it. That's the story of Double Feature, right? Is that you put one thing next to another thing, it might make a good thing bad if you do it wrong.
I mean, that'd be like, you know, you have to think of, you think of all art as complementary to the art surrounding it, right? It's the same reason, it's the same reason that, you know, fucking Rob Zombie doesn't open for Britney Spears. I mean, that would work, but you know what I mean? Like, it's, if you have...
You see that Zombie Manson Revolver cover, by the way?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, fuck yeah. Look up, if you haven't seen this, look up the Revolver cover, Rob Zombie and Marilyn Manson. It's the back to back. It's really cool. Context. It's important.
It's, if you have... It's a detriment to, it's funny because it's usually just a detriment to the second thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It can, but it can also greatly enhance the second thing. So in a double feature, hypothetically, since that's a good place for us to dabble, the first film is always going to stand on its own. Boca is always going to be Boca. But if Boca does a bad job, the Signal has a lot to work with, or work up to, rather, because you need sort of, if with a tonal shift like that, it can essentially destroy the thing that it's shifting into. A comedy shifting into a drama, you're just like, I was just laughing and now I don't like this.
Right, yeah.
You know, a drama switching to a comedy, maybe that works because you go, that was a little bit heavy and I'm ready to laugh.
Yeah.
And now it's extra funny. But it's a tricky move, and you definitely risk alienating a large portion of your audience. That's why I'm baffled by something, you know, another anthology like ABCs of Death. I'm just surprised that not every single person went, let's do jokes.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, and also in ultra short form like that, jokes are, you know, that's the safest bet.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have a normal narrative film, you know, if you're doing something heavy, there is a choice to be made if you want to cut it on occasion with something light. And if you have a movie that is generally heavy and you're about to ask the audience to go through another chunk that's heavy, maybe you take a time out and you do something darkly comedic just to make sure everybody's got a second to breathe and then can get on board for the next piece. And you can double use that to, you know, just to work another purpose, like informing something about the characters or turning something about the world. And you would do that in a narrative feature. So as an anthology, it's only making a decision to switch tone that a feature might make if it were doing the exact same thing. In an anthology like an ABCs of Death, it doesn't make a decision to switch tone because it feels like that's what's right for the story that you're moving through. It's doing that because the people who got the letter M thought that funny would be good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, or rather a bunch of people did the letter whatever, and this is the best one. But in a movie like The Signal, that's the right tone for that moment of the story. That's the right thing that the movie needs. So even if you said, it's too hard to make this a good anthology, let's make a feature film here, then you might still elect to spend 40 minutes in a dark comedy in the middle of the movie, and that would be a weird, bold, and special decision.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only thing about that is that's kind of a long time to spend totally switching the tone of the movie. But if you say it's an anthology, then it totally works. And you get to move from one kind of storytelling to another. And then out of that, when they do the more apocalyptic chunk at the end, and the more apocalyptic part of the movie can also really deliver some of the heaviest stuff, which is great because that's the conclusion of the film. Just mm-hmm. imagine switching the tone of any of these. If you start right. the movie with something that has the tone, not the story, obviously, but the tone of the third one, it's just like, wow, this is just so fucking heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you spend the whole thing, you know, you flip the third and the first, and you spend the whole third act, let's say, running away and doing this exhilarating thing. You know, you're going to be exhausted by the time you even got there. If you spend the whole last third of the movie doing a humorous chunk, it seems like you're discounting. It's just the exact right tone for these things to take. And it's so smart, the way that they're arranged, the different look that everybody has, and kind of the excuses of things you can do because you're in that place. Think about the first portion of the movie. Can't really play with AJ Bowen's character's weird, you know, confusion over who the characters are
mm-hmm.
because it's such a large choice that it's kind of too funny. It
sure.
just wouldn't really, I mean, I'm sure they could find, Dave Bruckner did the first one. I think Dave Bruckner's wicked fucking talented. He also did Southbound. He did one of the
yeah.
chunks yep. of that. And VHS as well. Mm-hmm. But I think that first chunk of the movie, like the editing is ridiculously sharp for a low budget thing. You know, it's very high on iconography. I fucking love that knife ball stick thing that the guy mm-hmm. makes. It's just like a wad of knives duct taped together on a fucking coat rack or something. It just kills me. But, you know, it would be really hard that section totally knows what it's doing. It needs to be making those choices. I think it would be really hard for it to do some of the things you're later going to need for that character because they are comedic. I don't know that I've ever seen an anthology that really like fired on all cylinders like this and seemed like it was better for having been an anthology.
Right.
Not, oh, this managed to get away. I don't come on here going, this is pretty good for an anthology. And that's the
right.
thing about it
right.
that's so cool to me is Same. this would be a worse film if it were a narrative film in the traditional sense. The anthology actually works to enhance and help what could have been a narrative film. I can't really think of anything like that. Doublefeature.fm? Is that where we're going?
Yeah, that's where we are.
Is that what happens now? Doublefeature.fm, patreon.com/doublefeature. Hey, you know who I want to thank this time on the show?
Ooh, tell me.
Tom Leonard, Bruno Hunziker, Ben Eckert, John. Thanks for the movie, John.
Hey, thanks, John.
Hope you dug the signal. Brett Hayton, Billy Wilson, Charles Crawford, and the Abbot of Unreason. So we get another show. Those movies will complement each other. They'll complement these movies. Everybody's complimenting everything. It's going to be great.
It's a pair of movies about what happens when you dedicate yourselves to the ideas of other people. And we're going to start that pair off with that wildly popular Jim Jarmusch vampire movie, Only Lovers Left Alive, Ghouls. And then we're going to...
I love that you left a pause there, like, oh, which wildly popular Jim Jarmusch vampire movie are they going to do?
And then we're going to pair that with Amy Semit's Sun Don't Shine, which I think this is the only movie she's directed?
It is.
Cool. So that's easy.
Yeah.
Wildly, her most popular film.
Right. And that'll be the one where we get to see just another peak of the A.J. Bowen, because why wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. So until then, fair citizens, watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.